VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking Champions League, and there's some serious highs to debate. Not just for the British teams, of course, but for a certain athletic Norwegian striker too. That's right, Erling Haaland was at it again. Another stunning goal to beat his former team, whilst Liverpool snatched a late winner at Anfield too. But it's not all euphoria and comebacks, as Graham Potter started his Chelsea career with a draw, and Tottenham were beaten late by Sporting Lisbon. We'll also be talking Rangers and Celtic and the views from Europe with Ian Hawkey, as well as a little mention for the Football League. And we've got news of a special guest from the world of cricket. All that to come. This is The Game. Hello and welcome to The Game Podcast. I'm Tom Clark, standing in today for Hugh Woodencroft, who is away for the day at a wedding. Thankfully, though, I'm joined by the perfect happy couple, Gregor Robertson and Ian Hawkey, to discuss the latest action from the Champions League. Now, when you get the caretaker role, it's sometimes worth trying to do something a bit different. Try a left field tactic, maybe. But let's be honest, you can't get away from him. So I'm going for the obvious. Erling Haaland. Another stunning goal, another winner for Manchester City as they came from behind to beat Dortmund 2-1. Now, Ian, I'm coming to you first with a challenge. It's your first show of the season. Can you think of something new to say about Erling Haaland? Over to you.
Well, we could avert our gaze slightly from the wonderful finish and praise the wonderful cross, but that wouldn't really answer your question, would it?
That's cheating. I think
Pep Guardiola got in before me by likening the goal to a very famous Johan Cruyff goal from the 1970s. Which was similarly athletic. So no, it is hard to think of new superlatives for Haaland. But I guess what he's done is he has scored a different type of goal to the dozen. I think that he's already scored for City and reminded us that really there's very little in his portfolio that's not possible. I mean that was a variety of skills, wasn't it? High jumping, hurdling. And magnificent timing.
Gregor, you've been tasked once again. I was down on the editing floor before coming up here. Let's get Gregor. Poor old Gregor, just because he played a few games in defence at some point
in League One
in football. Gregor is being asked for about the fourth time, how do you defend Erling Haaland? But there is a genuine point, and Ian made it with reference to that amazing cross by Cancelo. In defending that goal, is part of the beauty of it, the cross, in
Absolutely.
That it's outside of the foot. As a defensive line, you're probably looking at it and going, well, he's right-footed, he's not going to cross now.
Yeah, but it's also across the back post like that is actually one of the hardest things to defend. But usually it's because a winger's coming in from wide, and at the back, almost to the byline, and that sometimes it's just impossible to reach for a defender. So you really got to focus on cutting out the cutback, if you know what I mean, or trying to get a block in the finish. But Haaland is so big, and his levers are so long, and he's so kind of strangely, awkwardly athletic that you didn't need a winger coming at the back post. He just threw the outside of his left foot at it, and it was a goal. So really, from a defensive point of view, that moment was, I'd say, almost impossible to defend against. But the thing, if we're trying to say it's anything new about Haaland, from watching him increasingly, I think his biggest strength is actually his patience. Because he did nothing. He did nothing for the majority of games. I've said that earlier after watching his first game. It's striking how little he does and how little he has to do. And to maintain a kind of ability to be able to explode or to just make the right movement at the right time As I say, that patience. And look, he's still doing things. His mere presence on the pitch is drawing defenders towards him. It's creating space for others, and it's probably imbuing a ripple of anxiety through the team, through the opposition. But it is still striking how little he does. He touched the ball 26 times last night, and that's quite high in comparison to some of his Premier League games. I know it was that famous one when I think he was 8.
Yeah.
And I think he got an assist in that game. So that is the most striking thing for me. The patience he has and his ability to just switch it on at the moment and make the deciding, the telling action in the game.
But it's working, isn't it? And that's what the brave people during the summer who dared to suggest that it might not click this quickly for Haaland and City said that, oh, wait, it's a change in system. They'll have to change the way they play. Ian, that was something we debated quite a lot on the preview shows and things. How have you been impressed with the way City have adapted to Haaland's arrival?
Very, because I think that it has meant them curtailing some of their instincts. And also, I think possibly he had to curtail some of his instincts as well. I think there's a temptation now to decide that because he's such a brilliant centre-forward and there's a vacancy for an orthodox centre-forward in a very well-developed City team, that sort of imposes a ceiling on him. I mean, Erling Haaland, he's got good feet, as I think we've probably all noticed. So his combination play, I think, is something that we are going to see more of. I mean, you're right that the touches of the ball are quite striking, and as Gregor says, his patience and willingness to make sure he takes up the right positions rather than feeling, lonely and diverting from the positions that Guardiola wants him in at the moment is a sign of his professionalism and discipline. But I do think we're going to see some nice interactive moments from Erling Haaland over the season. I think he's not going to look so distinct from the rest of the team that, he looks like a slightly sort of oddball specialist.
He just keeps getting better and better. Now, I'm going to throw a curveball out here, guys. I might have started with Erling Haaland, but John Stones, for me, better goal. Anyone? Gregor, you're a defender. Step up. 1-0 down. Outside of the foot.
If I'd scored,
top corner.
If I'd scored, I would say it was a better goal. But no, I mean, because you've got to look at the goalkeeper, surely, don't you?
Yeah, true.
I think so.
Maybe slightly.
Yeah, and also, as Ian pointed out, the cross was just a thing of beauty. I think the commentator was saying there's no one better in world football at using the outside of the right foot. And the only person that sprung to mind for me was Modric.
Mm.
But he is remarkable at it. He's kind of edging the ball forward, and you see him edging the ball forward knowing that whatever happens next, he's going to use his right foot, even though it's, a position to cross with your left, because he's so good at it. And it was a delicious cross. So, that combined with the athleticism and the sort of jarring, impact of that moment, I'd say that probably top stone, sorry.
Outrageous. I honestly thought you'd back me up on that. I thought, got a defender in the studio with me, I'm going to get some support for this, but no. But Stones did start the comeback, and it was another comeback for City, wasn't it? I mean, we're going to talk about Liverpool and their late goal in their game, and the slightly different narrative, there's my word again, I've gone in early, slightly different narrative around the two seasons, because City have had a lot of comebacks this season, haven't they already? Ian, why do you think it is that we're kind of able to see City's comebacks as so overwhelmingly positive?
I think it's the overall impression of control, isn't it? That City are very good at giving the impression that they are controlling matches. That's what they are. Whereas with Liverpool, we see the obvious symptoms of they're not going through their very, very established drills effectively, whereas with City that happens much less and tends to happen the later stages of the Champions League and not really until then. So I think it's an impressionistic thing, it in that is City's self-assurance, and some of that is expressed in their patience, their confidence that if they are in control of matches, they will overcome a setback, and also that the opposition will have become exhausted by chasing them around by the later stages of games, and it's a pretty sure technique, certainly in the Premier League and in the early stages in the European runs.
Guardiola was right, though. They were poor in the first half and even start second, and it's just about, I think he used the word rhythm, didn't he? Changing the rhythm, a bit more speed and sort of intent in their play. And then they do, you know, they do. You do feel like they've got another gear to slip into.
Yeah.
But the other thing that is, I don't know, City have played better than they are now, than they have this season. Certainly in the Champions League, it's, you know, these games where there are such fine margins are won by moments a lot of the time. Look at, see Real Madrid for details. And now it does just kind of strike you that they have someone who can produce a moment from nothing that, or what looks like a kind of, I don't know, it was a delicious cross, but still, it's just you couldn't think of many other strikers being able to do what he did there. So, I don't know, it does make you wonder whether they've got a better chance of going all the way this year.
And what do you make, Gregor, of that, the defence for City? Because there was talk during the summer of changes. Ake was linked with a move away. They obviously brought Akanji in towards the end of the window. Stones playing at right back. Obviously, you've got Cancelo, this incredible player, essentially sort of playing out of position, if you can say that, although I get the impression he could basically play every position on the pitch sometimes. How do you think this kind of almost unsettled and yet settled nature of their defensive system seems to be working?
I mean, I think that does look like a bit of a patch together defence. Like Akanji, you know, but I don't think he's probably in their first choice back four or even three. So Stones did really well at right back, but this is not, I think, as Cancelo aside, this is not their first choice back line. But they have enough bodies, they have enough kind of options there. And I think that's why you saw them, you know, rebuff offers for Ake, unless they were going to, well, they did bring in Akanji, but I still think with all the sort of the different competitions they're fighting on, this is why they need all these players. And, you know, they will be tested. They'll be tested much more sternly in games to come. And I think probably we're more likely to see the players like Diaz come back in then.
Now, Erling Haaland obviously steals the headlines with the winner. But had it been different, had Dortmund got the win, we would all have been talking about Jude Bellingham again. There's an England squad being announced later this afternoon, which I'm sure we'll talk about in shows to come. But just on Bellingham, I mean, he's going to be in the squad, surely. It'd be a huge story if he isn't. But my question for both of you is, is he now got to be considered in these coming games for Gareth Southgate to be starting for England? Ian, start with you.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think Jude Bellingham is probably the most coveted English footballer in the world now. If you think of Harry Kane's age, would that be a realistic claim?
Yeah,
would that be an interesting claim?
Perhaps
not.
Yeah.
I think it's very hard to. It's very hard not to imagine that he's going to have a really important role for England. This calendar year. His position, which is he covers big territory. He's a very good all round midfielder, as we know, with a tremendous engine. England are reasonably well staffed there, I think it's very unlikely that he's not going to go to the World Cup if he's fit, with the idea that he's going to have a leading role.
Yeah, the question is whether he starts. It's, you know, Calvin Phillips, kind of slow start to life at City, could be an issue. Another issue, which I really don't think we should get into here, is the way that Gareth Southgate is going to play. I mean, the kind of dynamics of that midfield, whether it's a two or a three or whatever, let's not talk about that now.
There's no Hugh, don't worry, it's not going to happen. You've got Gareth Southgate's number one fan in the chair, Gregor, don't worry.
But we know that Southgate likes kind of discipline in there, and he is more of an all-action, box-to-box midfielder. But absolutely, he'll be well in his thoughts about potentially starting.
Yeah, well, we'll see what Gareth Southgate comes up with, not only with his squad, but with his tactical innovations in the coming games. But one manager with some tactical innovations of his own was Graham Potter, of course, in his first game as Chelsea manager. Now, in modern football, you don't want to read too much into a team sheet, do you? But Raheem Sterling out wide on the left, that's a pretty bold move, isn't it, Gregor, for your first game?
Yeah, definitely. There's a kind of trend, I don't know, I was thinking about this earlier on, there's a bit of a trend towards this. You look at Antonio Conte trying to, you know, move wingers, people who are traditionally been wingers, into wing-backs. And a lot of it is because I think when you kind of stock the midfield with the kind of midfielders that Conte certainly has, and also Brighton has. A lot of it's about, I kind of almost a box.
Mm.
Two defenders, or if there's a back three, and then two holding midfielders in front of them. So that really gives the license to the wide players to go and attack. In that sense, it makes sense for them to be much more attacking. So, yeah, look, seeing Sterling playing wing back was a bit jarring, but I think this is a part of a bit of a wider trend, personally. And he did it at Brighton. You know, someone like Solly March often played wide there, and I think he's more of a winger. And he did the same with Trossard in recent times. So, I wouldn't imagine it's going to be a long-term strategy, but if he is playing with wing backs and wants to go with two up top, or, you know, again, it's about the dynamics around that. It's hard to see where Sterling actually fits in then.
Yeah, but it is interesting you say, and that's why I kind of prefaced it with the slight element of caution. In modern football, we don't just interpret from the lineup on the pitch, do you?
Absolutely, particularly with Potter.
Absolutely. So, and I was discussing this morning, and when you look into some of the statistics, like average position maps and things, you see that actually what the system allowed for was Sterling to still be the most advanced forward on the pitch. In when you looked at Chelsea's average positions, he was the highest up the pitch, higher up than Aubameyang or Mason Mount. But similarly with Reece James, their touches were very much hugging the touchline. So they were, maybe it is the idea that you don't want Raheem Sterling in a crowded area, you want him to find him in space, which is exactly what he got for the goal, wasn't it? Coming in on the end of a cross from out wide allowed him to score a goal. I mean, but that wasn't just the only tweak, was it? I mean, there was one recognised centre-half on there with Azpilicueta and Cucurella either side of a back three. I mean, it was a pretty bold statement, I think, Ian, for a manager who, as he said himself, was his first Champions League game, not only managing, but actually being at one. What did you make of it?
Yes, it was bold. And I suppose if you're going to look at it from a business point of view, it was also quite bold to leave two new centre-halves out of that initial plan. Neither of them cheap. So you admire him for his boldness. I did find myself asking if we're soon going to get into a phase where Raheem Sterling is criticised in the way Trent Alexander-Arnold is for not covering behind him.
Yes, true.
Perhaps that's still a few weeks away. But I totally agree with Gregor. I think it is a trend that innovative coaches are not asking that automatic question, oh, you can't put this dedicated career winger as a wingback. Ousmane Dembele has been playing at wingback occasionally for Barcelona. Now, he would fit the absolute old-fashioned definition of a non-dedicated tracker back, typically, and, you know, very much a forward-looking player. But yeah, I think people are looking differently at systems and how much ground other people can cover, particularly with a back three.
Lucas Moura is another one at Spurs who,
yeah, of course,
in pre-season played a lot of games there. And I think, yeah, not sure how we feel about it, but Conte has an eye on converting him as well. So, but I think I referenced this last week when the line that jumped out from Johnny Northcross' interview with Potter was that he was saying, he almost described him as a post-formations manager. And it is about, you know, covering space and finding space and exploiting it. That seems to be more of his, you know, more of a priority actually than the way you send out the, you know, what the numbers are in terms of a three at the back or a four at the back. You know, he just wants the players to be in space and interacting well together and covering for each other. And, you know, that's clearly why he picked Cucurella and Azpilicueta too, because he sees the strength being them being on the ball and actually being able to join in attacks as well.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of talking about boldness and innovations and post-formation, that was one of the things that struck me most about this move, was that I kind of looked at it and was, Graham Potter's someone who is kind of everyone's favourite manager, isn't he? Even if you're not a fan of the team that he's managing, everyone seems to be quite a fan of his. And I kind of looked at it from afar and was like, oh, Graham, have you really gone for the right club here? Like, it, you know, there was just something about it that seemed to jar with me. But maybe the Todd Bowley era will be different. But, Gregor, how difficult is that for a manager? You know, because some of these things we're talking about, they're easy for Pep Guardiola to implement and tell Raheem Sterling, look, you're going to play out wide left, mate, and things like that. How difficult is it potentially for a manager like Potter, who, as we said, never managed in the Champions League, never even been to a game, making this huge step up to talk to some of these players and dropping some of those players, as Ian says? How difficult is that going to be for him in the coming weeks, do you think?
Yeah, look, that was one of the big question marks about the appointment, really. I don't know, the way he spoke though in his kind of unveiling as well, he was honest. He said, it's still about dealing with human beings. That's still the most important part of the job. So some of them will get aboard and some won't. And he's got to be backed enough to move the ones on who are not. So yeah, I mean, it's a different, very different challenge for him. But I think that what we're seeing, despite some of the strange utterances from Todd Bowley in particular, we're seeing the kind of change in culture actually at Chelsea, or certainly that's what they want. Whether, you know, if they're seventh in April or whatever, and you know, out of the running for the top four, and they can still hold firm, and there's like, I don't know, they're drawing 1-1 with Brighton, you know, whether they can sort of, because Chelsea have to win now, that's been their blueprint. Another thing that makes it so different is how different this is from who and what's come before. It's all been about ruthless winning.
Yeah.
That's what all the even the managers who've been in place since Abramovich has been at the helm have all just been winners.
Yeah.
And Potter's not been a winner yet. He's been someone who builds a culture, and winning's the thing that comes from that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that, because Ian, I wanted to ask you what the kind of view from Europe was, if you like, because Chelsea, as Gregor says, synonymous with sack a manager and then they go looking for the next biggest, brightest, most successful manager from anywhere in Europe, from Italy, from Spain, from France, and this time they pluck a bloke from Brighton. You know, has Potter got a bit of notoriety about him for what he's done across Europe, or are people a bit like, who?
I'm afraid there is a little bit of who. But just partly because, you know, as he admitted, he hasn't been spotted in many grandstands in the Champions League. And obviously, you know, he hasn't played in a major, in the principal European competition. I think the Östersund success was noted, but no more than that. At the same time, you know, there isn't so much of a show us your medals culture with managerial appointments anywhere now. You know, the head coach of Bayern Munich at the moment is a young man in his 30s who never played at senior level. Jose Mourinho never played at senior level, etc., etc. So I think, you know, whereas Graham Potter did. You know, Graham Potter had a distinguished senior career, if not a glamorous one. So I think in that sense, you know, I don't think there's scepticism. And also there's less, especially in Southern Europe, I think, there's less eyebrow raising about the high turnover of Chelsea managers, because, you know, it's a low turnover compared with certain Italian clubs. And it's not that much higher than Real Madrid over the last 20 years, really. So, you know, the idea of Chelsea sacking another manager, yeah, so what?
One other thing I wanted to ask you about Chelsea, Ian, was, and we'll come on to talk about the team he left, but Aubameyang, what was the kind of take on that move in Spain, in terms of, you know, not been at Barcelona that long before he then pops off again?
No, but who has been at Barcelona that long? I mean, it was, but by the end of this absurd transfer window, there was a sort of fatigue with all these surreal comings and goings, and by that stage, you know, the Barcelona narrative was all about, oh, how can we gouge another 20p from down the back of the sofa? Oh yes, let's sell this fellow that we got for free 5 minutes ago. Remember, Barcelona, Lewandowski was everything, and sort of is everything still. So you know, any collateral damage to ensure that a red carpet was rolled out for Lewandowski was sort of acceptable. I mean, I think you can feel a little bit of sympathy for Aubameyang. He was really good for Barcelona. He rescued their season to a certain extent. But you know, it's now just going to be another 6 month episode in his varied career. I think he probably deserves a bit of patience at Chelsea as well, because it all happened rather suddenly. And you know, obviously he had a quite disturbing incident at his home just before he left. But yeah, I don't think there'll be a lot of Aubameyang nostalgia.
No. Well, one man who will be hoping that Aubameyang definitely produces similar form for Chelsea is Todd Boehly, of course, Chelsea's new owner. And he has been speaking this week, hasn't he? He's got some big and bright ideas. Hey, guys, I know how to fix English football. What do we reckon to that impression, everyone? Pretty good?
Ah, yeah, awesome.
Yeah, thanks, man. But he did obviously come up. It's an idea we've heard in various forms before. The All-Star Game, North v South. I don't want to dwell on it too long. I must confess that when I first heard about it and thought, yeah, this could be quite good fun. And but I didn't know whether that was just me with my editor's hat on, thinking this is a great topic of conversation for load of articles, get the writers to give their teams, readers will love it. And actually, then when I thought about it, I found myself on the side of Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp, who obviously dismissed it fairly out of hand and said, if you can find a date in the calendar, which is already jam-packed, let me know. So I think I'm probably on the side of it's a bit of a gimmick. Let's move on before we discuss it too seriously. Gregor?
Absolutely on your side, yeah. I'm just kind of also a bit gobsmacked that he's not got like some PR advice somewhere. Like someone that he's actually having a chat with about his ideas, who knows about football. He clearly doesn't have that person because he keeps... I don't know. The thing about this is not just that it's a bad idea. You know, you can have ideas. It's just that it kind of just shows a bit of a lack of understanding, really. That's one thing, having room in the fixture list for it. Another is, why would the players have any interest in doing it? Like,
yeah, well, the idea would be, people have suggested, you know, charity games, things like that. But you're not going to get a level of intensity that you would want from watching that game, are you, if that's the case?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, people slag off the Community Shield.
Yeah.
At least that's kind of, it's got a bit of history and it's got a shiny kind of trophy at the end of it. This is, no, it was crazy. The more interesting thing was, for me anyway, was his talk about the kind of multi-club model that he seems to be aspiring to, which is, I don't know, that's probably got more going to have more impact on Chelsea's future. But I just come back to it. I think there, as much as he's saying he wants to change the culture, he's changed the manager, we're all very eager to see how Graham Potter's time at Chelsea unfolds. There's been also quite a lot of sort of worrying missteps too, in terms of the way they've dealt in the transfer market, his involvement in it, so kind of hands-on. And the way he's willing to kind of talk to people about just what seem to be his little thoughts swirling around in his head. I think he needs to get, first of all, he needs to get some PR advice, but he also needs to get some people into positions at the club that know what they're talking about, basically.
Right, Ian, we've teed you up. Ready? Team talk.
Well, okay,
over to you.
I'm going to be slightly contrary here. I do agree that North versus South is a silly idea and wouldn't work. I agree with Jurgen Klopp in that there is no space in the calendar, besides which these clubs pay an awful lot of money on these players and they don't want them to go and get injured having fun. However,
excellent. I was hoping there was a however coming.
Yeah, okay. However, I do think, I mean, there are ways in which this can work, and I think it can work for the reason that Gregor identified. The players have got to be engaged. They've got to have a passion. Now, North versus South doesn't work because it's not a concept. But if you had some sort of possibly regional game, which or maybe mini tournament. I can hear now that the calendar is is cracking as I say this. Then I think you might create something that people got interested in, and I can think of a couple of examples where it works elsewhere. I don't know a lot about Australian rules football, but I think they have a sort of state of origin thing, which is a highlight of the season. So you know, you might play for the Sydney team, but you might be from Darwin or something, so you play for Northern Territories against Victoria or whatever. And I think this works quite well there. And in Spain, you've had for a long time this tradition at Christmas, which was winter break time, of people playing for their regions. So people would go back for the Christmas holidays and play a well-attended, enjoyable, watchable fixture region against region. Now, this has become a bit politically complex in certain places now because it's when Catalonia play. They generally get good people coming either other regions in Spain or, you know, serious international sides. It's become a bit of a focus for nationalism, sovereignty, and so on. But it's a tradition that worked and had a hold on the popular imagination. And, you know, Gerard Piqué will always turn up to play for Catalonia. Cesc Fabregas used to try and come even when he was in England and so on. So, you know, it has a place. It has a place in the culture. And I think the players are engaged. That's the key thing. And because it's keying into sort of regional allegiance, they're back with their mates. And so it's fun. It's something they want to get involved in.
So, sorry, and you're suggesting that because that's slightly different in that they are from those regions, most of the players.
Oh, absolutely, exactly. So there's an engagement, there's a feeling. So now I'm going to talk off the top of my head now, and it's probably going to sound silly, but if you had, I don't know, the northeast of England playing against, should we say, Greater Croydon? you'd have a really good game. Yeah.
Sheffield would have a decent side as well, wouldn't they? Yeah. Good defence. Walker, John Stones. That's Barnsley. I'll get
that. Make sure I understand this here? Are we talking about players from the northeast?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's to do with your...
But you won't get many Premier League players there, and it's not much of an all-star.
You don't have to... Use birth certificates, but you know it's where they're from. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's not where they live. It's not where they play. It's where they're from.
Easy one to come back to that is that's what internationals are. But I get that's interesting. That's an interesting.
You do
idea.
Get a good bit of tribalism in England when you break it up. Anyone from the north who meets in London, they're mates.
When you're talking about east and west coast,
you pass Watford and you're enemies again. Honestly, I'm telling you. Well, look, Gregor, and at least Todd Bowley's found his PR man now. At least that he can run his ideas by him and Ian Hawke bouncing ideas.
I did begin this by saying north versus south is a silly and unworkable idea.
But you presented him with a better alternative, Ian, and that's what matters. Well,
I also had another idea. If you could bear with me on this. So you know, if you wanted some sort of exhibition for English football and what people like about it, you could also think about maybe having some sort of pre-season tournament which celebrated the internationalism of English football, you know, so you could have South America against Europe, maybe an all-African team, maybe a rest of the world team. This tournament's already taking a month, I can hear.
I mean, it's punchy, that's for sure. It also sounds a bit like the World Cup, but, you know, I'm not...
I'd love to see what the insurance premiums would be as well for the set that's turning up.
Look, I'm open to all ideas, you know, all bets are off the table. Hugh's not here. Let's just run riot.
See, Todd started a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll see what Todd comes up with next time he enters a press conference, all right? Gets a microphone anywhere near him. But up next, we are talking all things Liverpool. So we've already talked about City's comeback at the Etihad, where there was another late winner at Anfield. Liverpool picking up a late, late goal. Yol Matip just crossing the line to give them a big and important win in the Champions League. Now, we've already talked about the kind of narrative around City's late goals and the winners that they've had late on. For Liverpool, it feels slightly different, doesn't it? It feels like a team not quite gelling to me, and also gaping holes at the back. Goodness me, I never thought I'd see them concede so many chances at Anfield. I mean, Ajax really could have and probably should have got at least a point from that game. Gregor, what did you make of it?
I thought Liverpool were improved, absolutely. Yeah. But Klopp was right to say, you know, there's still a lot of work to do, and we're not going to get carried away by this because they were reliant on a last minute winner. But there were a bit more of the Liverpool we know in terms of the front three looked really much more menacing. Diaz in particular, that's the way he kind of runs in from left to right, and can shift the ball so quickly and get a shot off or link play. He's, you know, I think he's really stepped up. And Thiago, I think, of the performance that underlined how important he is now to Liverpool because of the way that teams now sit in and can frustrate Liverpool. I think he's got to be, you know, the way he orchestrates Liverpool's play is vital. So, yeah, there's still the odd hairy moment at the back, but I also think, you know, Van Dijk came out afterwards and spoke quite honestly about how he knows he's not been at the level he can be, that he's had a dip. He had a little dig at kind of ex-pros and commentators who have sort of been a bit less than understanding of that in the knowledge that players do this. But I think also, you know, clearly we've got to speak about Alexander Arnold as well, just in the because of the fact that the goal came down his side again, and he was just slightly out of position, stepping out a bit too much, and the space was exploited. And it's almost like, you know, I think, well, clearly some teams are targeting him now, and it can only be a fraction. It can only be one moment in a game, but that's sometimes enough at this level. And you know, but again, it's the same kind of conversation. You combine that with what he gives Liverpool going forward, and some of his passing, it's just sublime. So it's certainly not you know, everything back on track for Liverpool, but for me it was a much improved performance.
I want to come back to the defence, because you obviously raised the point about Trent, but I think there's a bigger issue with the defence. But you mentioned the front three, and I found that really interesting that you were picking them out, because the startling thing about that was that they were without their big summer signing. Now, we've talked about one team who've adapted to a big number nine coming in, a leading man, really well. Ian, how have you seen it? You gave us your view on City. How have you seen kind of Liverpool's transition, if you like? Because to me, I feel slightly like maybe the sending off against Palace has knocked Darwin Núñez and Liverpool a little in terms of their progression through the changes. But it's interesting that Gregor picked out the forward line, which was missing Núñez.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a very bad thing for. Remember, quite a young player, you know, really, really desperately seeking momentum, knowing that he's come into a club where a very, very popular predecessor has left and sort of opened up the vacancy. And you know, and obviously blotted his copybook with that sending off. So yeah, and you know, there's such a momentum team as well, Liverpool. So yeah, I totally agree. That suspension was bad for club, bad for manager, and very bad for player. But I guess there was a slight tendency possibly to forget about Diogo Jota in all this. You know, he's really important, and he's one of a few reasons in terms of, you know, players returning to fitness and trying to get some form, for which Liverpool can be quite optimistic, Thiago being another. So, you know, I do think, with fitness permitting, it's likely that we're going to see a slightly more recognisable Liverpool quite imminently, or at least after the international break.
Now, I mean, obviously a lot of people made a big deal of Haaland and Núñez, you know, coming in at the same time, both to the top two teams. But it is interesting, isn't it, when you think about, you know, Gregor, you mentioned Diaz, Ian, you've mentioned Jota, but obviously they've still got their star man, Mohamed Salah, who they gave a massive contract to. And if you compare that to City, say, who sold Raheem Sterling and brought in Haaland, that allows for a more easy switch, doesn't it, in terms of how you might want to play? Because, yes, they've still got Phil Foden and Riyad Mahrez, but they're all kind of rotating cogs in the machine, aren't they? They're very effective and very skillful players, but they're not Mohamed Salah in the same way that he is for Liverpool. Do you think we're going to see a bit of a drip feed of Núñez, if you like, because of the Salah factor, in that he's still there and he's still the main man, Gregor?
Yeah, look, I think they would have liked to have seen more of him so far, obviously. But I absolutely agree. I think Jota was brilliant, and I think we kind of forget the impact he made and the way he sort of forced Firmino out of the team, really, while offering something similar in the way that he can sit, he can sort of drop a little bit, and both the left and right can sort of drive into the space and bind. And you got to see the Liverpool's opening goal came from that. It was striking, in fact, how often Alisson went really direct from when he had the ball at his feet, and one long ball, and that kind of crossover between, I think it was Jota and Diaz, led to Salah's goal. So I understand what you're saying about, you know, that comparison with City, but it's slightly different in Liverpool in that the front three are almost like an entity in them of their own. You know, it's the way that they have to both press for the front, which helps them defensively, and be so kind of dynamic and, you know, link well as well. And as I say, Jota has been very important in that. I think he showed that the other night. Yeah.
But my point more is that, as you say, they are an entity, but it's whether that Nunes upsets that entity, if you like. Whereas, you know, Salah, Jota, Diaz is more of your kind of archetypal Klopp front three. Ian, what do you think?
Exactly. But also, and in a way, more mature and worldly footballers. Darwin was still playing in the Spanish second division, 3 years ago? You know, he's... I think we should probably remember that in some senses he is still a developing player. And yes, at the moment, doesn't have some of the vision and certainly some of the rhythms that the other three do. But, you know, he has obvious other assets as well. I think any manager would like to be in a situation where they think they could rest Mohamed Salah, because the guy has played an awful lot of football this year, some of it in quite difficult, trying circumstances. But, you know, it's hard to leave him out and feel confident that you're going to overcome difficulties without your talisman. Also, the calendar puts Salah in a different position, doesn't it? Because he's not going to the World Cup, so you can sort of think that he's not going to be one of the ones that come back tired or injured at the end of December.
Yeah, well, another Liverpool talisman who may or may not be going to the World Cup, Trent Alexander-Arnold. Greg, you've already mentioned him. Now, we've avoided the big England formation debate, but we might have to do a little bit on Trent. But I did think about this, and I was watching the game. And is there any element where we have to look at Jurgen Klopp for this, as much as we look at Trent Alexander-Arnold? Because, as you say, Gregor, he is so important to how they play going forward. And the manager surely has to take a little bit of responsibility if he's then exposed at the back, because there was the chance at 1-1 for Ajax where Matip and Van Dijk were basically a back two on their own. And it wasn't like the ball was like, they weren't camped outside Ajax's penalty area. The ball, I think, was in Liverpool's half even. And Alexander-Arnold and Tsimikas were both already on their way, already in line with, you know, Thiago and the midfield. And they lost the ball, turnover, and that's where the chance came, and Ajax probably should have scored. So this is, you know, we have to remember, this is the way Liverpool play as well. This is why they get targeted, because it's not just about let's target Trent Alexander-Arnold, is it? It's about let's target Liverpool's fullbacks.
Or the space that they've
The space, yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that's not Trent Alexander-Arnold going, oh, I'm just going to wander forward. It's his manager going, get forward, because you're a key outlet for us and you're a key assist provider.
That's true in a lot of instances, but it was slightly not true in the instance of the goal. I think they were slightly different. You know, they were set, really. You could have been tucked in a little bit and a little bit deeper as part of a back four, and he stepped out and left the space. But you're right. Look, that's why we're saying that. As I was saying last week, that Liverpool's defenders need to be elite athletes, and they need to be able to cope with being almost two at the back. And as much as we said, there's a trend of trend for kind of wing backs being more attacking players, there's also a trend of full backs being sort of being used in kind of rotations with midfielders and wingers, and almost joining in the forward line sometimes. I said this last week about Dalot at Manchester United's done it quite a lot. Zinchenko's done it at Arsenal, and Trent Alexander-Arnold's doing exactly the same. It's another trend. It's about creating overloads against teams that you're trying to break down, who sit sit back and make it hard for you. So a lot of the time you can't blame Trent, and the, and what he does, what he offers Liverpool going forward, usually outweighs what, you know, any deficiencies at the back. But they've been exposed a couple of times this season, and they've not always been just because he's playing higher up the pitch because of his attacking output. Sometimes it's been a lapse, basically a defensive lapse, and that's the thing that he needs to rectify, really, particularly if he wants to play for England.
It does seem to me as well, Ian, that more than just the Trent and the fullback space, it does feel like Liverpool are a little bit more open as a team this season. I don't know whether that's the changes, whether that's the injuries, those kind of moments where, and also Virgil van Dijk, is it just me? Does he seem a little bit less colossal than he has been in the past? He seems a little bit, I'm not saying he's suddenly become a poor player, but he doesn't seem to have that superhero, don't worry guys, I've got this covered moments that he has had so much in the past. Am I being harsh, Ian?
No, I think that's true. I mean, and you know, we tend to notice his errors and his, you know, positional flaws because he sets such high standards. I know this has been said endlessly, but Liverpool played an awful lot of games in the last season, and there is bound to be some fatigue, and if it's not physical, it's psychological. It's to do with getting yourself up there twice a week mentally, and I think we'd be astonished if they didn't show, you know, some symptoms of having played every single game that was on the timetable last season.
Well, I wouldn't say got away with it. I think they probably deserved to win, but it was a late goal that got them the 3 points. Now, one team that didn't get a late goal and were on the end of a defeat, a slightly surprising defeat perhaps, were Tottenham in Lisbon, losing 2-0 to Sporting, with both goals coming in the 90th minute. Now, I was speaking to some of the Tottenham fans who I work with, and there's a lot of them in the office, and it was striking. It's something I said before on the podcast this season, which was when the opening game, when they went behind to Southampton and then came back and won. A colleague of mine who was in the ground said, I've never known anything like it. We weren't worried, even at 1-0. And even after this game, I spoke to the same colleague and he said, it's okay, it's fine. Probably needed a bit of a reality check. Gregor, is he right? Is this the Conte effect in full force? They're happy, they're settled, they've got good players, they don't mind losing the odd game.
We'll see how long that lasts. Yeah.
you think they should be a bit worried by this?
I don't. There's no doubt that Conte, not just in the way he plays, but also the kind of mentality that he tries to imbue in his team, we're going to see less of this, I think. And we have seen less of it so far under Conte. It was a bit of a kind of a late collapse.
Yeah.
But before then, Spurs weren't bad. They were probably deserving of a point. I personally wouldn't get too worried about it. Look, it's a different caliber of opposition as well in the Champions League, and there's also Conte's record in Champions League and whether it's going to be quite the same as it has been in domestic football. So, but I wouldn't be worried by this at all if I was Spurs. I just think it was a bit of a late collapse, and Spurs have been remarkably solid, particularly in the way that, as I've said, they've got the kind of three at the back and two in front, and it's very hard for teams to play through that. And again, it was a kind of lapse towards the end that lost them the point.
Ian, what do you reckon? Worrying signs for Tottenham, or just a welcome reality check after a good start to the season?
I think possibly a little shout out for Sporting, who were good.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
And lively Conte agrees with Gregor. Obviously, it's a real shock that they deserved a point. Do you think so? Lloris made some pretty important saves.
I guess that's part of my questioning in terms of whether they should be worried, because going into this game, perhaps, and maybe this comes from a naivety of the English media not understanding how good Sporting are, but it was telling that, as you say, Sporting were more than a match for them, and probably at the end pinching it, particularly maybe the home factor, it wasn't that surprising. So I guess that's what I'm driving at. This Tottenham team, you know, heralded this season for all the improvements they've made. looked, you know, second best for long periods in this game, Ian. So I'm angling for that, yeah, whether that should be a worry.
Yeah, sure. Yes, yeah. Well, I suppose, I mean, it's hard for all of us, I think, to place Conte's Tottenham, isn't it? What are their ambitions? I don't think they're going to win the Champions League. But I think they'll go through from a fairly straightforward group. But then again, I think the Premier League is probably the priority if they have to choose one. So I think they'll get better. There's quite a few new things to integrate. The mostly, apart from the final minutes in Lisbon, they look reasonably resilient and resourceful. How much we enjoy watching them by March? Mm-hmm. That might be another question.
I'll make sure to remember to come back and ask you that in March, whether you've been enjoying them or not, Ian. But very quickly on Tottenham, because I think we've got a piece on the website about this today, is that the right wing-back situation for them does seem to be quite a telling problem, I would say. You know, Emerson Royale, they signed Jed Spence, who Conte immediately then came out and said, he's not my signing. And despite being an incredibly exciting prospect from the Championship, brilliant for Forest last season, of course. Gregor, how do you look at that position on the pitch? Do you think he's going to be kind of, you know, Mourinho-esque, forced into playing Spence for a few games and then hoiking him at half-time and saying, I need another signing in January?
I think he'll definitely be saying, I need another January, January signing. That's what he does. I think Royal's a weak link. I think we said that in pre-season, really. He's not good enough defensively, and his output is not consistent enough going forward. Look, I saw a good bit of Jed Spence in the Championship last year. He's a good player. I think he could certainly get an opportunity, but Conte sees him every day in training.
Matt Doherty's
the other one. Yeah, he's been injured. He's not had a great time at Spurs, really, I think, over the piece. He improved last season, but certainly wasn't great under Mourinho. But I think a lot of fans would probably quite like to see him given a chance, and I'm sure he will get one. But I think in the medium term, that's probably another area that they're going to be looking to strengthen, because, as we said, that's a very, very important position in Conte's system. And again, we could see Lucas Moura getting tried out there as well.
Yeah, we shall see whether Jed Spence will get a chance for Tottenham in the coming weeks. We've still got a little bit of time left on the game podcast, and we've got to ask Ian all about European football, and me and Greg are going to sneak in a little mention of the Football League. That's all still to come.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Ian, I've already mentioned it's your first show of the season, and so I thought we'd do a little bit of a quick fire. Gregor and I are going to ask you a few questions about European teams and what you've noticed this season. And I'm going to go first, partly because I've thrown this curveball at Gregor and he's looking at me across the studio as if to say, you didn't tell me about this plan, what's going on? But he can think on his feet.
He didn't tell me either. Yeah.
I like to keep you all guessing. You know, this is how it works when Woozencroft's not here. You know, plan goes out the window. Freestyle it. Now, First one, nice easy one for you, Ian. Barcelona. And we've followed them all season. You've written lots of excellent pieces for us in the Times. The thing that was most striking to me in their defeat against Bayern Munich was that I kind of looked at their team at the start of the match, and I thought, you know, so much has been made about all the money they've spent, all the signings. I kind of looked at that team and thought, I mean, it's still not that good, really. I mean, I wasn't particularly impressed by it. I mean, is it still a massive work in progress? Is Xavi under pressure yet? What's the mood in Barcelona at the moment?
Well, I think as a result of that defeat, they are taking, most people are taking the positives because Xavi's got credit in the bank and the club have got a lot of debt for the long-term future. But it was better than before. So, you know, Bayern have been a barometer of Barca's decline in quite a stark way. They beat them 8-2 in 2020 in the Champions League in the quarterfinal, last 16. And then they beat them twice in the group stage last year, which sent Barca into the Europa League, you know, which is something that hasn't happened for the best part of 20 years. So having gone to Munich and played pretty well in the first 45 minutes and probably should have had the lead in the first 45 minutes, that was progress. Mm. But as you say, also with an 11, which has to be a work in progress because so many of them are new. Marcus Alonso was making his first start. Jules Koundé, who also came in the summer, was playing at right back, which isn't really his preferred position. Andreas Christensen, another new player, was part of a basically all new or almost all new back four. Pedri was brilliant. Pedri was probably the best player on the pitch. The one thing I would say, and possibly hasn't been shouted out, certainly in the Catalonia press, is that having got to halftime, 0-0, Lewandowski's missed a good chance. Barca have looked really quite good. They then concede two goals almost immediately after halftime. Now, I think that makes Nagelsmann look much better than Xavi. Mm. You know, it's a narrative thing, but Bayern solved something and executed it pretty well, and ended up being on top in the second half and probably deserving winners. But no sense of crisis yet. However, it's in theory a very complicated group because Inter are in it as well. I don't think Inter are particularly powerful, but it makes the next two games, Barca, Inter, potentially, you know, there's jeopardy there. And meanwhile, the new signings mainly roll on successfully domestically. Lewandowski has been sensational. He had a poor night in terms of finishing in Munich, but otherwise he's been excellent, and he's a focal point. He seems to have a good relationship with Pedri on the pitch, which is important for their creativity. Ousmane Dembele has mostly looked like he's enjoying having Lewandowski as a target. So, in a sense, some of the important things that need to work are working.
What about Bayern, Ian? Owen Slot went to Munich, and he was obviously there was a big narrative around Lewandowski playing against his former team, but the man who's been signed, if not to replace him, certainly to score some of the goals that they'll miss, Sadio Mane. Mm. I think he was asked some fairly pointed questions afterwards about, you know, how smoothly he's slipped into the team. How's that transition worked?
Yeah, yes. I mean, he started off well, but then as Bayern have been dropping points, Mane has looked like not the perfect fit as yet, put it that way, and he didn't have a great night on Wednesday. So yeah, there is quite a barrage of questions about whether Mane is going to work and whether he can possibly fill Lewandowski's big boots. Thomas Müller was talking a bit before the game about this transition. And he said, well, we've got, a little like we were talking about earlier, actually, we've now got a central striker who's not, you know, less of a obvious target man. So it means we might be less predictable than we used to be. But I think if that argument is going to work, Mane probably needs to start scoring more goals. I mean, you know, they are a very well equipped attacking team. Leroy Sané has been good in the last couple of weeks, and you know they've still got a huge supply of wingers. And the other player who's been playing very well in a fairly attacking role is Jamal Musiala. So. The one that got away.
Thank God we haven't got to work out how to get him in the England team as well. It's bad enough having Jude Bellingham. Ian, finally, the holders, Real Madrid, 2-0 win against RB Leipzig, 6 points from two games, top of the table. Carlo Ancelotti is going to do it again, isn't he?
Well, I mean, he's got every reason to feel satisfied. Although, you know, rather like against Celtic, they were, you know, they didn't look very comfortable this week, but you know they pulled it around late on, which is so much their trademark now that it barely needs reporting anywhere. Courtois made important saves as ever. The issues around Madrid are there's a post Casemiro thing. There's how long can the midfield last? And in that sense, Ancelotti should feel quite pleased because Fede Valverde, who was the fourth midfielder next to the famous trio, has been absolutely fantastic this season. And the new signing Aurelien Tchouaméni has looked good and solid and confident when he's played. So. So the idea that the great midfield trio was going to be broken up and everything would collapse from there is being challenged. They've been missing Karim Benzema, who may or may not be back for the Madrid derby this weekend. And, you know, he really is their only true centre forward. So the goals are going to have to come from somewhere else. For as long as he's out. And so far, Valverde stepped in. Vinicius has stepped in, so they're managing that, but tougher tests ahead for sure.
Yeah, well, we shall see, but they've definitely made a good start, and slightly ominous that, as you say, they can lose those players such as Casemiro and still look fairly potent in the Champions League. Ian, we're going to let you go, mainly because me and Gregor have got a little two-minute chat about the Football League. That's coming up on the game. But just before Gregor and I get into the nitty-gritty of the Football League, I'm here to tell you about a very special bonus episode of the Game podcast. On Friday, I sat down with Ed Smith, former England cricketer and chief selector for England cricket between 2018 and 2021. Ed joined us to talk about football, tactical innovations, and his new book, Making Decisions, Putting the Human Back in the Machine. He also had a little mention for his beloved Arsenal. Now, if you're listening to this show at the weekend, that episode with Ed is already out, so go and track it down. If you're listening to today's show on Thursday, stay tuned, and it'll be out tomorrow on Friday. But here's a little clip of what you can expect.
I've watched a lot of Arteta as a player, and I was very interested in him. I thought he was an outstanding decision maker. My book's called Making Decisions. He was a very good decision maker. And actually, you were very conscious in watching Mikel Arteta play of his intelligence. I would say he was one of the most intelligent players I've watched a lot of. And I also sensed at times he was a second manager. Mm. And I sometimes remember, you know, conversations with the man, not just as a club captain, but it went a bit further than that. He was an extra shaping mind on the field. So you knew that was there. And then, of course, he went to Man City as assistant manager and formed that alliance with Pep Guardiola. And then has come to Arsenal, and I think he's doing a very good job. I'll also say one thing about Arsenal, which is easy to miss. I'm 45 now, and I've had different positions in sport, inside and outside the high-performance part. I've come over time to see the game more through the lens of, if you like, the top and how that filters down. And when I say the top, what do I mean? I suppose I mean the decision-makers at CEO and board level and how that then supports and nurtures the decision makers closer to the pitch. I think sustained success is very difficult without there being clear strategy right at the top. And I think Vinay Venkatesham has done a very good job at Arsenal, appointing and then supporting and sticking with Mikel Arteta. And also just getting the club lined up right in a way that sustainable success becomes more likely. There's never a guarantee, but equally, it hasn't been a surprise. I think most people who follow it, the club, could sense that it was moving in a good direction. And, you know, hopefully it will continue like it has done at the start of this season with some dazzling play on the field. Mm. But I think it's very hard to have sustained success without that clarity and that direction from the top.
So now this was going to be the cute little ending, me and Gregor, no woos and croft, no worries, just a little nice little chat about the Football League. But no sooner had Ian Hawkey hung up and left us behind as Robertson stands up, kilt, Scotland tattoo, says, what about Rangers and Celtic? And he's quite right, he's quite right. Well, he had hoped to get Michael Grant on to talk to us, but he's sadly stuck travelling back from Celtic's match. So we'll have to make do with you, Gregor, instead, to tell us about Rangers and Celtic. Now, it's two differing nights for both of them. I think we should start with Rangers. It comes down to the sending off, doesn't it, as James Sands, really, that game. I do think it did feel a little bit like they were clinging on for large parts, but the sending off we were talking about beforehand, it was a foul, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was unlucky. I think it's a bit harsh to say they were clinging on. Rangers were good. This is a very different, you know, look at the scoreline, 3-0, and after the humbling defeat against Ajax, it's not been a great start. But this is a very different performance by Rangers. It was a good performance up until the sending off. And then it was a mad few minutes in which, you know, penalty kick was saved, then scored on the rebound, then a retake was ordered, then Alan McGregor, 40-year-old Alan McGregor, saved the second one. And then unfortunately they got another penalty. And James Sands, I think he was unfortunate in that he, you know, he did really well to track back, and he went to win the ball, and the ball was kind of slightly behind Simeone, and his touch kind of took it forward, and although the ball clipped Sands' calf, it was a foul, and it was kind of, I think he was quite shocked actually that it wasn't going to be overturned, but it was a penalty, and then from that point it was really hard for Rangers to get anything from the game really. But I think they should be buoyed by that one, particularly we know that Ibrox is going to be the place where they have to get points, and I think until this ending off it was a really good performance. So Celtic on the other hand, they will feel really, really disappointed after the sheer volume of chances.
When you say they, do you mean you? Or do you mean they?
I'm a neutral when I'm broadcasting. I mean, God, the chances, they just kept coming. They kept coming towards the end, and I think that's 16 efforts. And look, Michael Grant really kind of did make a very valid point in his match report when he said that in the 21 years since Celtic first reached the Champions League group stage, they've only avoided defeat 6 times in 31 games. So like, this isn't, as although you can have come away from watching this game thinking, God, they really could have had the 3 points there, it ain't bad going away and getting any points actually for Celtic. But Shakhtar looked out on their feet. They looked dead on their feet, and you know, there were some great chances. Giacomakis on his left foot whipped one just past the post. Maeda on a stretch, it was almost like a kind of a la Gaza 96, just couldn't get enough on the ball from the ball across the box. And Jota went on an amazing run, brilliant feet, and then the turf gave away under his feet just as he went to pull the trigger. He was thinking, no, this is not going to be Celtic's night. So I think Michael Grant said it was, you know, they travelled 1,000 miles to take a baby step, but it was a baby step forward nonetheless.
How do you feel about Postecoglou and rumours linking with him?
He's poo-pooed that. It's not happening, I don't think. I think he sees he's playing in the Champions League.
That impartiality went quite quickly, didn't it, the listeners?
I certainly hope he's poo-pooed it. He made some kind of promising noises anyway. No, look, it's bad timing. It's bad timing. I'm not someone who's going to sit here and go, you know, it's Brighton, or, you know, compare them to Celtic, because the world that we live in now is that any move to the Premier League is going to be enticing. But I think Postecoglou, from where he came, what he did last season, and what still lies ahead in terms of the Champions League programme, and what Celtic have done in the first two games. Their first 3-0 game against Real Madrid didn't feel like a 3-0 game either after the, you know, the first, certainly the first half anyway, and they were just punished by kind of ruthless kings of Europe in the second half. But Celtic have been good. They've been good in both games so far, and there's no reason to, you know, we see how bad, how poorly Leipzig start has been. We have no reason not to feel that we can do something in this group, actually.
There you go.
I know, sorry.
He cracked eventually, I knew. Well, now you're full fan. One quick one I wanted to ask you about Celtic, as well as Postecoglou, something we've talked about is their recruitment. You've mentioned Jota for Liverpool. There's another Jota who seems very, very impressive in that Celtic's new signing this summer, isn't it?
Yes. He was on loan last season, was made permanent, and yeah, he's a real talent. As I say, that kind of mazy run he made into the box, it's he's got great balance and kind of an ability to send a player the wrong way while kind of doing very little with the ball, if you know what I mean. He kind of steps over it or runs beyond it and then goes the other way, and yeah, real talent. The recruitment has been great, and Hatate is someone who's a joy to watch. O'Reilly as well, who came from MK Dons. I mean, been some kind of left field ones, and Greg Taylor was a Kilmarnock player and didn't have much. You know, he took a while to make an impact, but he's looked like a different player at left back, and it was his cutback actually to Giacomakis for probably the best chance towards the end of the second half. So yeah, looks like a well rounded team. Slight vulnerability on the counter, and that's where Shatter scored the goal. I slightly wondering about Joe Hart and that he kind of went to ground slightly too easily, but certainly all to play for still.
Absolutely. Now, can we talk about the Football League?
Let's
quick.
Let's do it.
Come on. We've got producer John, Nottingham Forest fan, forgetting about those years in the Championship. Now he's a big-time player in the Premier League, waving at me going, too long. Well, listen, Woozy's not here. I'm in the hot seat. We're talking about the bloody Football League. And I'm telling you why. The reason why is because we've talked about the Champions League. We've talked about all these superstars. You will not see a better goal this week than the one Sunderland scored at Reading. Their third. If you've not seen it, get on Twitter, get on YouTube, track it down. It is absolutely sublime. From the goalkeeper all the way up the pitch, basically one touch. I think there's two back heels in there. There's a brilliant ball right across the Reading defence. And Jack Clark, who's a player that, you know, shone at Leeds early on in his career, moved to Tottenham, things stalled for him. Takes a lovely touch when a lot of players would have tried to hit it first time. Takes a lovely touch inside a sliding defender, which presumably is every defender's nightmare when they end up on their backside, and smashes it home. 3-0 win for them into the playoffs under Tony Mowbray. They lost Alex Neil, lots of their supporters, some of whom I know. My good pal Kenny was very worried. He supported them for a long time. He's thinking, here we go again. I told him, no, don't worry. Tony Mowbray's your man. Do you not think, Greg?
Yeah, something kind of, it's certainly been a very positive start, and you feel like there's certainly life left in Mowbray. And it was a bit of a, I don't know, the way that he parted company with Blackburn sort of, it seemed to leave a little bit of a bitter taste in his mouth, because he did so much to turn that football club around, and the Venky's kind of, you know, toxic atmosphere at that club, and he changed it all, and he spoke about them in positive terms, and he certainly formed a very attractive team on the pitch. And he showed he was quite kind of flexible too. Last season he went much more direct with Blackburn. He saw that it wasn't quite going to get them to where they want it to be. And I think, although they just missed out on the playoffs, he did good work there. And I don't know, he's from the Northeast. He's had a time at Middlesbrough. I know that's it's not many miles away. And he's something about it feels like it could be quite a good fit. And as you say, it was a worldie of a goal. I mean, it's kind of, that's the kind of goal you show any fans who shout, you know, get rid. This is why they do it. This is why they take the risk.
Yeah.
Because that can be the outcome. And it, you know, like Sunderland won't that won't be the outcome for Sunderland all the time. It's not the outcome for Manchester City all the time. But when it comes off, it's a joy to watch, and yeah, great moment.
Absolutely. And it wouldn't be a show with me hosting without a mention for Lincoln City. I'm not going to mention them this season because they're absolutely useless, but one of our former managers, Danny Cowley, looks to have finally got it going at Portsmouth. 6 League One wins so far, 20 points. They're just behind top place Ipswich, got another big win in the week. Looks like they finally got things going at Portsmouth, doesn't it?
Yeah, but look at that top five. Ipswich, Portsmouth, Plymouth, Sheffield Wednesday and Bolton Wanderers. that's a big five in League One in the third tier of English football.
Yeah.
And they've all started really, really well. You know, as you say, McKenna Ipswich is, from all I hear, is playing some sublime football. That's kind of, might not necessarily always get you out of League One, but it certainly started very well. And I always think Bolton, are on an upward trajectory with Ian Evatt and the way they play as well. So yeah, League One, as always, is kind of the tightest, maddest league probably in the country. Everyone thinks it's the Championship, but if you look down at League One, there's nothing between teams very often. So it looks like it's going to be a fascinating league this season.
It's the place to be. It's what I try and tell everyone. And before John pulls the plug on our microphones, League Two, go on, Gregor. You've got one team you're about to tell us about.
Leighton Orient. Yeah, I'm going to shamelessly plug a piece I've been writing about Leighton Orient, who have started brilliantly. They've won 7 out of their first 8 games under Richie Wellens, the manager, top of League Two. But actually, the piece I'm doing is a bit more of a kind of historical piece, if it's the right way to say it. It's about the kind of changing demographics.
Oversell it.
I live in. I know, yeah. Listen, hear me out. I moved very close to Brisbane Road, and I've noticed that the place is changing. There's a massive development on their literally on their doorstep, of which is going to be like 6,000 new homes. And it just got me thinking, it's like a fast changing part of East London. You know, this is a massive opportunity for them. They've got, you know, American investment, very kind of forward-thinking owners who want to be playing the Championship. And Leighton Orient are a fascinating club in that they're hemmed in by West Ham, Spurs, Arsenal. They've never really had a part of, you know, they were formed in Clapton, actually, in Hackney. They've never really had a part of London or an area where they've got 4% of their season card holders are from Leighton, live in Leighton. The rest are strewn all over the place and often in Essex. Madness. There's been talk about them moving to Essex over the years.
Really?
Yeah. So now they've got this huge kind of change around them in their local environment and a massive development on the doorstep, big opportunity. They're going to be starting doing things like giving every household, new household, a welcome pack with like a scarf, a hat for the winter, free tickets.
Yeah.
And they're going to try and attract, because they've never been able to get kind of more than 5,000 fans through the gate. So I think Leighton Orient this season, because of Richie Wellens, but also in the years ahead, could be a team to watch.
Here's us thinking you're a Celtic fan. Actually, you're Leighton Orient.
You heard it here first.
Get on down to Leighton as soon as you can. And if you do read Gregor's piece and you don't find it as exciting, you can just go and watch that Sunderland goal. I'm telling you, if you do one thing before the next episode of the game...
It will be exciting.
It won't be as exciting as that Sunderland goal, I'm telling you. If you do one thing, listeners, before the next episode of the Game Podcast, which is out next Tuesday, go and watch that Sunderland goal. Thanks for joining us on the Game Podcast. If you like the show, rate us, subscribe, and don't forget, I think this is the bit where Hugh says sign up at thetimes.co.uk and all that kind of jazz. You know the drill by now. We'll see you next Tuesday.
The train is now approaching junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.